It's funny because I've been to tournaments before where the amount of technology needed prior to the TrackMan style era was already massive. I mean, the amount of infrastructure to just broadcast one event was extraordinary. Now it's very, very different. I remember seeing some commentary from some of the big golf brand CEOs talking about how the game was really at the cusp of introducing a new level of inclusivity from a player point of view, introducing a new generation of people to the sport, people that never experienced a sport before. And surely things like TrackMan and other technologies have enabled that to become something you can play with friends if you've got something at home, or whether you're going to an indoor studio now. That was never a thing 5 years ago. How is that feeding into the demand for the sport?
We could spend hours on this topic alone. There are so many things that have changed the way that people play golf, right? And there used to be this perspective from some of the golf organizing bodies and from some of the more conservative figures in the game that golf is only golf if you go play 18 holes, right? Like that's the only way you can define
It's very
golf,
traditional.
right? Incredibly traditional. We don't think of it the same way when we think about basketball, right? Like if you go play pickup basketball in your driveway, you're still playing basketball, right? If you play horse, you're still playing basketball. So it took a little bit of like a mindset shift and things like Topgolf, right? Things like the technology that you're talking about, things like other new concepts in mini golf and other areas, to kind of come along and be embraced by the gatekeepers of the game, right? To be able to allow other people to enter the game in different ways. And in the end, if you go to Topgolf and play for a half hour, if you go hit balls at the range, if you go putt with your kids, whatever it is, still playing golf, right? And eventually, our hope, especially as the organization that we are, and what's in, behind our mission, that eventually those people go play 18 holes of golf. Like that's what we want. And so this whole feeder system that maybe didn't exist before is much more active than it was previously. And that has led to incredible increases in participation in the game. Especially, it's almost like we look at COVID, and COVID had a role in that, right? When people were home and looking for social distancing things to do, golf was a pretty good one. We were worried that that would drop off as people started to return to normal life. It hasn't happened. And we think that one of the reasons for that is because of this whole feeder environment that has been created that just creates a much larger universe of people potentially playing golf. So for us, all of these tech advancements have been positive as it relates to people participating.
Can we go back to how you, as a senior leader in this partnerships area, think about sizing up new partners that come to you? Because I'm sure that there are a number of partners that, the inbound inquiries you would have would satisfy a certain number of criteria that are really great for the PGA. And your professional instinct will play a role to that. What are you looking for? And maybe what are you not looking for when it comes to people coming to you to say, hey, listen, here's our brand. We'd like to make this work. Not necessarily with naming names, but what is your framework for trying to assess that beyond the commercial upside that the PGA can benefit from?
Sure. I think the what we're not looking for is almost an easier one to answer. What we're not looking for is someone to write a check. Like that's not who we are as a brand. That's not, we need revenue, we need money, but that is not the driving factor behind the deals that we do. Because of who we are, the PGA of America's mission is to serve our members, that 30,000 that I was talking about before, who are teaching the game, growing the game, and then growing the game more broadly than that as well. That's our mission, right? So if we're looking at partners, we want them to be able to help us achieve one or both of those things. And I think when we look at our partner base, it's really easy to pick on a few examples that really do that. I kind of keep going back to T-Mobile, because they're a good example of a lot of these things. But from a growing the game perspective, even just the fan environment on site at our events, if you go, when we are running the Ryder Cup or we're running the PGA Championship, we're building a temporary city out on a golf course. And there is, you would imagine, like your cell phone connectivity is not what it's supposed to be. What it would be if you were just, at your home or at your place of business. And so T-Mobile comes in with an incredible workforce and basically creates this connected environment for us that allows us to do all sorts of things that make the fan experience better on site. And, you know, in our mind, it maybe not directly, but indirectly growing the game of golf, because those people have a great experience and then they'll come back and watch again, or they'll go home and play, whatever it is. So that's one example. Another example close to home for us is Corebridge Financial. So they're life insurance and retirement brand. And they actually run the PGA of America's retirement program for our members. Mm-hmm. I don't know how familiar your audience is with the team of 20, but at every PGA championship, we have 20 PGA member professionals who qualify for the PGA championship. So, you know, some mm-hmm. people probably know the Michael Block story from a few years ago. He came through that qualifying process. And these guys are local club pros who qualify. And every once in a while, you get a Cinderella story like Block. Corebridge actually came in and we created a program with them where they sponsor that team. And get, you know, pay that team to participate in things. So give them additional funding to kind of make sure that their experience is great, give them other resources to help with their preparation and in the lead up to that event, and then highlight the team afterwards. So for us, it's a sponsor who's coming in and really looking at like what's most important and closest to our brand, and then getting behind that, right? So it's not just writing a check, it's finding that intersection between their objectives and our needs and blowing it out as much as they possibly can. So that's one of our favorites, because it's one that doesn't, you know, always get reported all the time. But when you get a story like Michael Block, there's a lot of exposure behind it, and it's really, really cool.
And when you think about the duration of those partnerships, do you typically enter into ones which are, I imagine, 3+ years, 5+ years, or are they ones which, because I, whenever we're coaching, I very strongly recommend that people in these kind of organizations never entertain anything less than 3 years, because it does take time to really find your feet with these kind of partnerships. What's your point of view on that?
It's hard to disagree with that. I mean, occasionally we'll have a partnership that's two, but that's really rare. I think, you know, we have three is usually the bare minimum. We have partnerships that are, you know, 8 to 10. A few of them, and those, you know, those are ones where the fit has just been so good for so long that everybody kind of knows what they're signing up for. And we're lucky enough that even though the contracts that we've signed might only be 3 to 5 years, we have several partners who've been with us for 10, 15, 20, even 30 years. Our relationship with Pepsi is now going on, I believe, year 32. So way before my time. But it continues. And I think, you know, I talk about this with my team all the time, that the testament to like a really successful partnership team are not the partners that you're bringing in, it's the partners that are sticking around.